Let me start from a summary of last time, and today we're going to switch topic. So if there are questions about these, I'll take them at the beginning, and then we move on. So we spent the past three lectures to try to understand how symmetries are encoded in phase space, and we came up with this triangle of homomorphism of Lie algebras as an important conceptual tool to visualize what's going on. So the three structures are a phase space. So we have a Poisson bracket or a symplectic form. And on this phase space, we have functions. Once we're given this function, one of these functions, we can always build a Hamiltonian vector field by plugging into one slot of the Poisson bracket. And what we obtain is one specific vector field called the Hamiltonian vector field. It's not, this is really not surjective in any way. So the point is that this map preserves the bracket that are given on each of the on these two spaces. Then we said, okay, let's think what happens if you have a group acting on our phase space. And well, in fact, we just looked at it infinitesimally in terms of a Lie algebra. Then we have an action. And the action, by definition, is a homomorphism of Lie algebra between our Lie algebra and its image in the vector fields over field space. So in one case, it's the algebra of rotations, and in the other, is how the objects actually rotate in field space. Then we try to close the triangle, and what we found is that we can close it if the action admits a momentum map. In fact, an equivariant momentum map. Well, should be more technically a co-momentum map, but is not really too important. So now we discussed that we discussed theorem about the necessary and sufficient conditions for a momentum map to exist, and we found that it exists if a momentum map exists. If and only if we saw this funny map is zero. Is the it vanishes identically. So we found the necessary and sufficient condition. It might not be, it has some nice corollaries. That is, if the image is trivial, we get it for free. If the source is trivial, we get it for free as well. So in one case is if G is semi-simple, we saw, and in this case, it's just the fact that the topology of phase space is simple enough. Okay, next we wonder, okay, but here there is also this equivariant condition. And we struggled a bit. So what does the equivariance mean? Equivariance, maybe I write somewhere the very important relations that defines the momentum map. So the momentum map is defined by this, or equivalently by by this. Okay, and the point is that this J hat is a map from G, linear map from G into the function. Now, its equivariance means that Jxi, J eta is just the Lie bracket is this homomorphism property. This can also be written as by that J eta. Okay. So then we had a discussion about, okay, how can this fail? Well, this can fail if there is an extra term here, but the term must be constant. So we found out that it cannot. These type of objects are encoded into cocycles of the two cocycles of the Lie algebra. So in that case, what it means, in fact, is that if we happen with the two cocycle here, what we can do is to simply modify this algebra here by considering a central extension of it, and then the triangle would close. So in a way, in practical application, I would say, what this is saying is that the equivariance condition appearing here is not too crucial in some sense. We can always tweak the picture a little bit and make it work. So it's not a huge violation of this triangle. Okay, so maybe I put it into parentheses, so it's technically necessary, but it can be adjusted for. Okay, whereas the existence of the momentum map is something that is not guaranteed, and it's guaranteed locally in the sense that this is a global obstruction over phase spaces topological. Okay, so we went through all of these. There would be one last topic that would naturally close this discussion, which is the topic of symplectic reduction. But I'm a bit stressed that I will not have time to do what I want to do, so I'll skip it, but it's in the lecture notes. So, see lecture notes for. And I'm a bit sad, because it's a topic that relates to gauge theories, which is what we are interested in this course. But maybe I'll pick it up later on. But for now, I prefer to move on to field theory and see how we can recover the structures from a Lagrangian, or at least going towards that direction. Okay. Any questions about the first three lectures? Okay, so today will be a bit more of a, at least at the beginning, a relaxed lecture, because I'm going to introduce notation and set up the stage for what we need. So, this is chapter 2. Have you seen symplectic reduction with Giuseppe or not? No. Okay, well, I hope I can come back to it then. So now what we want to do is to do field theory, not just mechanics. And in fact, what will happen is that what here is phase space will be a space of fields. So it's an infinite dimensional phase space of objects that live on spacetime. So we will be dealing with two types of geometry in parallel. There will be the geometry of spacetime and the geometry of field space. In field theory, two relevant manifolds. One is spacetime, M, which is of finite dimension. And two, we have field space. I use field space in a very generic sense. There are different types of field space that one can think about if one looks at the space of histories, the space of initial conditions, and so on. But like generally, there is some infinite dimensional space of fields. And this I will call F, and it has an infinite, it's infinite dimensional. So here, this will be the analog of P, right? In this previous, so if there is a, if there is some symplectic structure, will be put on this infinite dimensional space, not on spacetime, because it's the space of configurations of the theory and so on. So plays the role, or something derived from it will play the role of P, at least morally. Like, there are technicalities, but this is to say that on such a space, we want to do geometry. So we want to put differential forms, consider vector fields, and so on. So we will need some notations and some tools to deal with this. To do geometry on F. And this is what I want to discuss today. So it's useful to, in fact, maybe I need a bigger blackboard. It's useful to do it in parallel with what we do in finite dimensions. So I will write down the notations for objects in over spacetime and in field space in parallel so that we can compare the notation, which I will use for the rest of the course. So here we have spacetime. So let me start first by introducing some hypotheses on what kind of spacetimes I'm interested in. So I will be interested in globally hyperbolic spacetime. So M will be of the form sigma cross R. In many cases, I will still denote M. Sometimes M will just be sigma cross T initial T final. So I'm looking at it in between an initial and final time. To not introduce too many names, I will still call it M. This is still spacetime, and sigma is a Cauchy surface. So what is the picture? The picture is of some manifold, which can evolve in time. So this is a boundary-less manifold sigma. So this is time evolution, but there is no boundary there. That's why it's dotted. And so I will call this sigma in and sigma final. Do I use, yeah, sigma in, sigma fin, and this is M. On M, I also have often, not always, but I can have a metric G. And on sigma, there will be some metric H. Another important object, which is induced from G in the way that we saw in the course with Ruth. Another important object that we have here is some normal NA, which is a vector normal to our surface. Okay, so this is the general setup. In some cases, not very often, but in some cases, we will consider sigma with boundaries. What does it mean that sigma is boundaries? You can take it very literally, but probably it's not the most convenient way of thinking about it. A better way, I think, is to think of considering a subregion here
that evolves.
So I will still call it sigma, because otherwise there are too many names and we get confused. But if I don't say anything, sigma is boundaryless. Otherwise, I will say it explicitly. So here we have this green blob. And this green blob, if I have to draw it, I'll draw it like this. And in this case, we do have also a time-like boundary. So we have both a normal N, but also a normal S, which is within sigma going outside here. What I will call my boundary of sigma, I will call it C. C is the space-like boundary, so the boundary of M will be sigma in, sigma out, cross C times T in, T final. And these, maybe I will call it B sometimes, but whereas here, the M is sigma in with the orientation reverse and sigma, I call it final, sorry, not out. Okay, so this is just notation. A useful object to keep in mind here is the binormal. Which is normalized, I think. I forgot how I have it written. Okay. So this is an object that it's a bivector, which is normal to both n and which is the binormal to a codimension two surface in four dimension, or in general of a codimension two surface. So there are lots of formulas involving n, epsilon, and so on in the appendix to the notes, which are useful to do computations and to switch from form notation to tensor notation, which is always a bit of a nightmare. Nico did a great job last year to cleaning up all the prefactors, signs, which is quite awful. So, okay. Now, one last thing I want to mention is the following forms. I will use this notation. Suppose N is a submanifold. Of dimension n. So it's useful to adopt this notation. I can write differential forms on n, but also it's nice to write differential forms of the given co-degree. Instead of going forward in degree, sometimes it's useful to go backwards, because volumes sit at the top, and then we go backwards. So when I write top, I just mean this is fixed by the dimension of the manifold I'm looking at. So it's quite intuitive, but I want to say this explicitly. And so if I change what I put in here, I don't have to give names to all possible dimensions, which is confusing. I just write top, and I'm sure about what I'm talking about. Okay, so this fixes what I want, my notations over spacetime. I still have to talk about how to do geometry on it, but like taking lead derivatives, differentials, this is the usual story. So I will just rewrite it in parallel with the field space one. So to start, let's see what field space is. What is this manifold F? So F in all applications that we are interested in and that I know of, F is always the space of sections of some bundle. This is denoted like this, where F is a bundle, fiber bundle over M. Okay, so I think most of you have seen this with Giuseppe. However, let's see what it is in simple examples that are actually what we're interested in this course. So let's start with example one. Will be, let's take a particle. Particle as a one-dimensional field theory. Well, maybe this example is a little counterintuitive. Let's start from something more intuitive, a scalar field. Scalar field. A scalar field, what is F in this case? F is equal to M cross, I don't know, a real scalar field. M cross R, which goes to M with the projection on the first factor. So sections, the space of section is nothing else than space of R-valued function of in F. Does this make sense to everyone? Okay. Then two, GR. In GR, what is F? Well, F is a bit more complicated. It's the space of symmetric tensors. So I then let me denote it like this. It's a bit of an ugly notation, but there's no way of winning this. So this is a symmetrized, or maybe is a symmetrized tensor product. So I take what do I mean is that So gamma MF is equal to symmetric two contravariant two tensors. Covariant two tensors. So this is just to say that I can write down the bundle. You know exactly what the metric is. So, and then one has to add the fact that they are non-degenerate, which is a difficult condition to impose. Because there are always sections which are degenerate. So, but that's at least it's a subspace of that bundle. Then, finally, an interesting, a very common example, which is Young-Mills. For Young-Mills, the description of the bundle is not so easy. It's even harder than GR. But there exists. I will not attempt to define it here, but there exists a bundle such that gauge connections can be written as sections of that bundle. It's not very intuitive, and it requires more technology that I want to introduce. Finally, let me rather introduce the last example, the particle. So three Young-Mills. A is a one form valued in G, and F is the space of connections. It can be done. And four, let's look at a particle as a 1D field theory. So 0 plus 1 dimensional. So what is in this case? So here, the manifold M is equal to time. And the configuration, so if you want the fiber of F is, how did I write it? M is M cross R3. So if it's a particle in three dimensions. So if we have n particles, this would be Rn, the number of particles. Does this make sense? So I can even treat particle systems in my formalism. If I want the parametrized particle that we saw in the tutorial, M is this parameter time, and F becomes M cross, so this is just R, this is again just R, this is M cross R4, because I'm including time in as a coordinate, configuration variable. So all these, anything I'm interested in can fit into this framework. So I don't need to change the framework. If I'm doing finite dimensional system or infinite dimensional ones, I can use the same technology for all of them and just specialize at the end. I saw maybe a question, Marco?
Did you? No, I was just wondering, particles as, is that 3 plus 1D or?
No, 0 plus 1.
0 plus 1.
So there are zero space-time dimension and one time dimension.
Oh, I see.
So it's a one-dimensional field theory where space-time is one dimension. There's only time-space becomes field space somehow. It's a twist in the way I think about the.
And why is f m cross r to the 3?
Oh, if I have n, so what is? Q of t is a section of f, which is functions of time into R3.
Oh, I see.
Okay. Maybe I should call it f. So the histories of a particle are fields over this field space, well, the space of sections of this bundle.
Okay.
Good. So this covers a few things. Now we get to the new part where we try to do geometry on F. Geometry on M and F. So let's start with M. So I write a table where M sits on the left and F will sit on the right. I don't need that much space. I think this should be enough. So here we have vector fields. Is the first thing one introduces, because remember they are, well, there are, okay. First a general warning. There are usually many ways to define objects on this column which are equivalent. For example, vector fields are derivations of functions, they are tangents to curves, and so on and so forth. Or sections of the tangent bundle, they're all the same things. Now, when you go to infinite dimensions, some of these definitions might not be equivalent to each other. So one has to, if one wants to do things properly, one has to be extremely careful. Particularly complicated is the situation with forms, which are dual objects, and when you dualize in infinite dimensions, all sorts of things can happen. So I will work formally. These are not definitions. They are formal expressions that can be made sense of in the appropriate setting. Okay, so this is not a mathematical course in infinite dimensional geometry by any means. So here by vector fields, I mean an object that has x, which can be expanded on a basis, on a coordinate basis, and looks like that. One important property of a vector is that it allows us to define derivatives of functions. This is the limit for epsilon that goes to 0 of f of x I plus xi minus f of epsilon of xi divided by epsilon. And it gives us okay, very, very straightforward. So what is the analog over here? So here, I will denote the same object with this double symbol. I will just double every symbol instead of using calligraphic stuff, which is very hard to write. I just write these double things. Okay, so here, what do we have? Now, a point here is x, and a point here is some configuration phi. Not phi at a point, it's phi. So x will be, at this point, some integral over dx of, and here I need to be a little bit careful. So take these as a formal notation. We will make it clearer how to apply to functions later. So this is a formal equality. This will be some variation associated to my vector field that derives my vector fields. My configurations. So you see the analogy is that this index I becomes the position of the label x. And if there are more, I will not write it in the following formula. But if this has many indices, there can be also a sum over the internal indices. I'll just keep it to keep the formula a bit lighter. And now the coordinate over field space is the field itself. Does this make sense? OK. Now, how do we derive a function? And this is maybe a bit more interesting, S. So let me assume that I'm interested in local functions. Sometimes they're called function nulls over f. And so these are functions of the following type. They're integrals of functions of phi and its derivatives. And I will assume that it does not depend on higher derivatives than the first one. But the generalization should be rather obvious. So in this case, I can write how this is derived. So this is a computation you've done many times, but I want to do it slowly because there's a little twist. So this becomes the derivative of L over d phi times delta x. Let me do it in two steps. The integral over dx of the what do I call it? S. ds over d phi dx phi. And the reason I write it like this will be clear in a moment. But don't put the delta, if you're taking notes, don't put it on the other side. Leave it there. So this is dl over d phi at x module delta x of phi plus at x. So this is like the coordinate, like, no, sorry, the component of the vector field plus dl over d di phi di of delta phi x. As you see, this object this is a differential operator. So in that way, this is just a formal writing because it doesn't really reflect the true structure of what it means to take a derivative in. And in particular, this is not the functional derivative in the usual in the sense that you usually use when you take the equations of motion and so on. Because as you can see here, I haven't derived integrated by parts. So this is more this type of definition where I'm considering two neighboring configurations. So this is equal. You can get easily convinced that this is really the limit of s at phi plus delta x phi minus s at phi divided by epsilon. There are boundary terms in these expressions. There's no, you can't kill them. So this is not the Euler-Lagrange derivative. When I write it, I mean the full thing with the boundary terms included. Does this make sense? Okay. So here, differentials. Here I can write df, but I look at this. And df is just the sum over I, df over dxi, dxi is essentially this formula with the slot open. And here I want to do the same thing. Write d of s is, now I can't use my new notation. Okay. Again, as a differential operator. Now, once I have these, I can wedge them. I can do all the usual things. And I want to I can in particular use Cartan calculus. So on M, what do I have? I have D, I have the contraction with the vector and the lead derivative along a vector, which when applied to differential forms can always be computed like this. And in F, I have the same formulas now with D. I have some fat D, some double D with my X, and some double L with my X. I will not use this notation, but in lots of the literature, this is a delta. The problem with delta is that sometimes it's used as a vector, sometimes as a to denote a vector, like I did here. This is the component of a vector. Sometimes it's used as the form. It can be a bit confusing about what kind of object I'm looking at when I look at the formula. So we'll keep the delta for the vectors and don't touch it for the forms. So I will not use this notation. Just the most basic example of this Lie derivative formula is that I can write delta Lx of s of a functional as Ix of ds, right? Which is dx ds over d phi times, well, I can write it like this. Since these are space-time operations, they don't really see my field space one, which goes across and becomes dx, that's a delta phi, ex d phi, which is the component of that. So this is the sort of manipulations that I will do all the time. One more object which is needed. Is mixed forms. So now I've just told you about forms in field space and forms in space-time. But when we do computations, you have already wrote them many times without knowing, there are mixed forms. So that appears naturally. So mixed forms alpha in PQ M cross F. So these are forms on the combined manifold, which can contain, for example, both type of, let me write one simple example. I can write something like this, EXA wedge. Okay, this can also be written, of course, as d phi wedge delta phi. It might look there's nothing really confusing. We will see that these forms have appeared already in your computations elsewhere. So. Okay, now, since there are these and delta, I need to tell you how they behave with respect to each other. So here I'm using this notation on purpose, where this is a total form on a total manifold. So the only way to make sense of this type of notation is to say that the two anticommute. Because they're like differential over the same big manifold into different directions, roughly. So, but they are part of one big differential. So this is like saying, I will not use this notation, but suppose I define some big D, which is D plus delta, D square must be zero. Okay, so this is the same thing. Now, this is where things get a little bit confusing. In most of the physics literature, where instead of this guy, when uses delta over there, they're made commute. I give a tentative explanation of why this does not create issues. But there are situations where if you use one convention or the, well, this is not a convention. This is how things should be done. If you use the other way of doing things, you could potentially run into problem. I've never seen a situation where it happens. And I think there is a practical explanation, but there is no theoretical explanation. It's more because of the kind of quantities one is interested in, at the very end of the day, are not one forms, but they are always plugged in with what one is interested in is variations along some vector field. So what one is taking is mostly lead derivatives and not differentials, and those would commute. But one has to be careful when one deals with things. So I in a previous version of the lecture notes, I was using the physicist convention because it's so much easier to keep track of signs because they just commute through. But I decided to be fully consistent and use the right one. So I'm revising a bunch of signs, which is, yeah. So this is just a heads up. If you read papers, you will see them commuting very often. Okay. If this holds for consistency with everything else, you also need, so the point is, if you look at how Cartan's calculus work, D and I are odd objects and L is an even object, yes?
Just clarification, where is the P and the Q in the alpha is in omega?
Ah, so this is a one form over, okay, thanks. So this is a one form over M and a one form over F. So in this case, we get this is omega 1, 1. And this is 1, 1. And this is the other one. I could even put, I don't know, a Laplacian in front of here just to make things look more complicated, and it would still be a 1-1 form because I'm not introducing d-axis. There can be derivative acting on that guy, but it wouldn't change what it is.
So to see that like d squared is 0, I have the anti-symmetric property of the wedge product.
Yeah, so the wedge product, exactly. So the wedge there is only one wedge product for all forms.
Okay.
So the, so one wedge for all. Because you can think of them as forms in one bigger manifold, and there is just a wedge for that big manifold. I will, And what matters is the total degree. So if they commute or anti-commute is the P plus Q degree at that point. So alpha 1 wedge alpha 2 is equal to minus 1 to the P1 plus Q1 plus, I don't want to say, no, it's a product, not a plus, times P2 cross Q2 alpha 2 alpha 1, right? So if you think of these forms independently in a way that they commute, you would get a different factor here.
So if I know cohomology of D and bold D, do I know the cohomology of B?
Okay, there are theorems about this, but it's a big topic in the calculus of variations, in fact. So these technologies were invented for mathematicians for the calculus of variations, differential equations, and so on. That's why they're useful in physics, because we do take actions, extremize the action, and so we're doing calculus of variations over for actions, and so this is why their technology applies.
Yeah? I'm just thinking how to compute the cohomology because small d takes me in like one space.
Yeah, yeah, you have a double cohomology. It's called a bivariational complex. Uh-huh. You can have vertical cohomologies, horizontal cohomologies, and mm-hmm. So there is a more refined cohomological picture. So again, using these ideas, you have that D and I are odd objects, and L, the lead derivative, is an even object. So when you cross, when they go across things, they pick up a sign based on their on their degree. Does the so for example, we have that d I x is equal to minus e x d. So whereas if I try to go across with big D, since they are essentially matching, this will be this will give me the Lie form, the Lie derivative formula, right? So this is minus this guy with a correction, which is the Lie derivative. Similarly, since L is of even degree, this just goes through. And so in this way, the physicists really are really thinking of L and not so much delta. In most cases, that's why what they're doing works. But that's also why I'm choosing a slightly different notation to differentiate from what they do. OK. So this is even, right? Because it's made out of these two pieces. So you have to go across each. And so you pick two minus signs, and then it's a plus. Notice that we are introducing mixed forms. We do not introduce mixed vectors. We either do diffeomorphies over spacetime or in field space. Vector fields over spacetime or vector fields over field space. We will not need to mix it in applications. One can define them, but it's not. We're not needing them. So we'll not introduce any particular notation. So to a fundamental theorem, which again you used many times already, but I want to formalize it, is a theorem due to Takens, which says the following. If you have a top, top one form on a space like this. This decomposes as in the following way. In top one form, which are source type, and I will tell you in a moment what they are, plus, and this is a direct sum, top one form, which are boundary. So let's start from the boundary ones. They are intuitive. Boundary forms are exact forms. So this is the same as saying D of omega top minus 1, 1, F for the little d. What is a source form? A source form is a form that contains, well, that is proportional to d phi of x without derivative. So that is no objects like that. Okay, what is the, how do you prove this? Essentially, it boils down to integrating by parts. It's not the, there is a more formal way of operating, but in practice, you are integrating by parts, so that you move, you take your one form, you pick all derivatives over the delta phi, you write it as total derivatives plus something where the delta phi is factored out. This is how you take one form here and decompose it into these two. The theorem is actually telling you that there is a unique way to do this. So what is the obvious application that one has in mind is you start from a Lagrangian. L, of x phi d phi. So what is a Lagrangian? A Lagrangian is a top zero form. It's a zero form in field space because it has no delta phi sitting anywhere, but it's a top form on spacetime because we want to integrate it to get an action. So often we think of Lagrangian as scalars, but that's because we have a metric, we can write a volume form and transform a top form into a density time. But geometrically, it's better to think of it as a top form so that we can write S equal the integral of L. Okay, so if I have this, I can take delta L and split it into a source part and a boundary part. So the source part, what will be the source part? You all know the answers. Is the Euler Lagrange derivative. So it is the equations of motion. Okay. So this is equations of motion times d phi, where this is Lagrange dl over d phi minus d over d d phi. Maybe a. OK? Plus d of something, and this something is theta. So theta is a top minus 1, 1 form. Different authors have given it different names. Some people called it the universal current. We will call it the we should call it the presymplectic potential current, which is a very long name. So universal current, sometimes kind of rare. Most people call it So let's try to unpack this, and then we'll start from here next time. So we connect it back to physics, hopefully. So here, it's called a current because it is a top minus 1 form on M. So you know the electric current is either a vector field, or if I dualize it, it's a 3 form. Same thing here. So this is a current. And then conservation of the current in the form notation is super nice because you just say that is closed. So this is a top minus 1 form. And it's called symplectic because we will build phase space out of it. Will give us the phase space structure but in fact should be called pre because the kind of phase space like structure that it naturally gives us by integration it's degenerate so it's not a symplectic structure we still have to do one last operation to get to a symplectic structure which I will postpone a little bit into the course. So so pre means omega defined as the integral of sigma of d theta will be degenerate.
two form on F.
And this is to be expected because F is not phase space. F is the space of histories. So it's the wrong space to look at. So phase space, right, you pick a surface, which is what we have to do here. We pick a Cauchy surface, sigma. And we look at the initial data, the, I don't know, the electric field and the gauge connection at the fixed time. Or for a particle, in this example that I gave up there, we had positions and momenta at the fixed time. It's not the histories, the phase space of the particle. So this is not the right space to look at for a phase space structure. And this is, that's why this will be degenerate on that space. So we need still to do a step to get something on the generate. And to do that, we will, and we that's what gives us the final actual phase space. And in particular, for the particle, we will get a finite dimensional phase space. So we're happy. Well, at this point, it's still infinite dimensional, even in the case of the particle. So there's clearly something, some mismatch. And this is where, in a way, it's encoded. So for laziness, maybe I will call it the symplectic potential, but one has to keep in mind all these caveats. Okay. Am I okay. Maybe in the future, I will try to keep. I'm not sure if I will be consistent, but for forms, I put them in bold in the notes and maybe put an underline in at the blackboard, just to emphasize that these are forms on space-time more than field space. But just to know that this is the L with the top form and not the density and so on. But I don't know if I will be super consistent, but I'll try. Yeah?
Just a little question. For the symbols on the right, which are with double lines, does Math PB have support for lowercase letters? Or what are you using to write in LaTeX?
In LaTeX? There's a Math BB, but it doesn't work for lowercase letters. So I don't remember what it is, but I can tell you. But I had the problem with the paper. It was published with all the D's, double D's are missing from the printed copy because they didn't upload the right package. So we are in a bit of a pickle with the with the editors. So the paper is completely unreadable, completely wrong. And due to, so it's a good question in its own, in its way. Okay. Anything else? Okay. Thanks.